We're in the home stretch. We're almost there. It's like children getting in the car, going on a long trip, and one of the first questions they ask is, "Are we almost there? How much longer?" Well, we're almost there. If all goes well, we'll complete the whole set of verses by noon. So this morning, there's a ring back. Can you fix this? There's a ring back with the sound. Little review, as is our practice to do. A little different approach to the review. The those who are followers of the Vedas, we're followers of the Vedas, and there's others that are also followers of the Vedas. The Vedas is sound, like in the Old Testament it says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God." So, similarly, before creation, there's transcendence, and that transcendence is manifest in sound vibration, transcendental sound vibration from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayana or Krishna. From the Supreme Lord, there's sound. And then creation becomes manifest. That sound is still there. It's there after annihilation also. And that sound vibration is manifest in this world by different qualified persons, rishis, who they have their receivers. Just like here in this very nice, spacious temple room, how many different signals are passing through here? Radio, television, cell phones. Hopefully you put your cell phone and vibrate. And so many other signals. But we can't pick up on those signals unless you have a proper receiver. And you have a proper receiver, and then you can manifest that sound. According to the Vedic conception, sound is carried in ether, or Sanskrit word is akash, space. So before there's even space, because that's a material element, there's sound. And then there's creation, and sound is carried through space, or akash, or ether. And then some qualified persons have receivers. And then they have broadcasters. They can vibrate that sound. They receive the sound that, unless you have the receiver, you can't tune into. They have the receivers, and then they vibrate it. So the Vedic wisdom was made available that way, through sound vibration. Qualified people received and vibrated that sound. And then in the cycle of the ages of creation, the ages of mankind, every Dwarapa Yuga, every time the third cycle is near an end, there's somebody becomes empowered to take that sound vibration and put it in a written form. Because in this age, one of the deteriorations of quality is memory. People's memory deteriorates. So knowing that people's memory deteriorates, somebody writes it down. that sound vibration goes into a written form. But remember, it's eternal sound before creation, during creation, manifestation, and afterwards. So Vyas did that. It's a post. Veda Vyas, it's a post. An hour Veda Vyas is Krishna Dvaipayana Vyas. This we heard last Thanksgiving from the Pramana Kanda section. Our Vyas is a personal manifestation of Krishna who did that service. So it's very, very special. In any case, that sound vibration is manifest. Now, what's the purpose of that sound vibration? What's the purpose of Vedas? Well, it's to teach us what's the purpose of life. What's the purpose of creation? The purpose of creation is to provide living entities an opportunity to restore their original consciousness that is now in a covered condition. So it's a GPS. How to get to the destination, the goal of life, through sound. So, in summary, besides providing knowledge, or we can say information, certainly, in one sense, it's kind of an information overload for many of us. Lots of information. But the purpose of that information isn't just put in your information basket over here and now you can say, wow, I've got lots of information. Nor is it information that's to challenge and defeat others that have less information. It's neither of those purposes. It's meant for transformation. Awakening of our dormant consciousness to the stage of perfection. So involved in that application of that knowledge, there's contemplation or meditation. We heard yesterday evening, we're going to hear again. Dhyan, chapter 6 of Bhagavad Gita. It's a process of meditation that's elucidated within the Vedas. But the purpose of that meditation is awakening dormant consciousness of vastava, vastu. Ripened fruit, yesterday we discussed the tree of Vedic knowledge is called, compared to a desire tree. You can fulfill necessities of human existence through this wisdom of the Vedas. But the purpose is not just fulfilling desires. The purpose is very clearly stated in the Bhagavatam to go beyond desires of attempting the desire to again connect with the Supreme, our source of existence, our dear most friend and lover, Krishna. So it's more than information, it's more than contemplation, it's reviving our original consciousness of love. Emphasizing it again, there's a lot of information, but don't just information process like something academic. We all know how to do it, we're trained up in doing it, and it's really easy to do it. We just discern this from that, and now we got it. Now I have more information. Don't let it stop there. We use our to contemplate that understanding, new understanding, transcendental. What is the nature of the absolute truth? Just to review the section that we started yesterday, starting with text 50. Jiva Goswami says, this Srimad Bhagavatam is presenting the absolute truth. And he does so by referring to 112 Bhagavatam. dharma projita kaitavotra paramo nirmatsaranam satam vedam vastavam atravastu shivadam. That's the Sanskrit. So the emphasis went to vastavam vastu. What's that? You remember that nice diagram. We've seen it several times. There's the absolute reality, and there's the connection of everything with that absolute reality. That's sambandha. Everything comes from some source, and all those things, how to interact with those things so that we connect with the source, the absolute reality. So then he asked the question, what's the nature of this absolute reality? That's the subject of Srimad Bhagavatam. What is it? What are some of the characteristics of this absolute reality? Then text 51. He referred to another verse that says, as for a starting point, that absolute reality is non-dual consciousness, Advaita Gyan. Very important verse in the whole Bhagavatam, because it's stating the nature of the absolute truth is non-dual consciousness. And it has three aspects. It's not only one aspect, it's different aspects or different stages of realization of that absolute truth, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. We heard a lot about Brahman because Shankar was a proponent of Brahman. That's it. But according to Srimad Bhagavatam, the exposition of the authority that Shankar is under says there's more than Brahman, there's Paramatma and Bhagavan, and there are aspects of the same absolute truth. So what is this Bhagavan feature? Well, all three of them, non-dual consciousness. And there's implications. The non-dual conscious supreme has his part and parcel living entities, means they are also, as he is, eternal and conscious. Well, there are some people, he initially doesn't say who those people are, but there's a group of spiritualists, the Buddhists, who say no. Consciousness is not eternal and unchanging. We have the experience. Consciousness is always changing. Blue consciousness, yellow consciousness. And you leave one and take up the other. And that's, so there's all there is the moment. Kshanik Vijnana Vada, the doctrine of momentary consciousness. And there's a whole doctrine that goes with it. So they oppose the idea that consciousness, the soul is eternal. There is a soul, and that soul is eternal, and the soul has consciousness. So to that, Jiva Goswami presents the view of Vyas, specifically through the Srimad Bhagavatam. And it's repeated four times. So now we're going to repeat it again. So this is now review. Text 53. You've seen this slide. You see, it's all the ones I'm showing. Almost. I've added a couple more. So there's this view that says, but we see consciousness of something blue fading and consciousness of something yellow rising in its place. Doesn't this mean that consciousness is impermanent? Kshanik means temporary or impermanent. Consciousness, that's our experience. Consciousness is impermanent. And to that, Jiva Goswami responds by saying this verse, Chapter 2 of Canto 11, text 38, that you have in your handout booklet, This change is due to the power of the senses. Consciousness is one and persistent, but by the power of the senses, it seems to be, that's the Maya part, it seems to be many. The transformation of consciousness into forms of blueness and so on come and go, granted, but consciousness itself does not vary. It's very clear. I gave the example of a bulb. Supposing we went and, you know, painted this one pink and that one green and that one yellow and that one blue. And it doesn't change the light that's coming. It's just what you perceive. Blue, red, yellow, green. But consciousness is unwavering. But as it extends out, it may be colored or it may be influenced by the contamination of the covering. So the particular set of senses. So then Jiva Goswami explains, the distinction between that which comes and goes, this is text 38 that we just referred to, and the point from which it comes and to which it goes, you know, the place of consciousness. A consciousness reaches out and contacts something that's changing, and then a signal comes back to that place of consciousness. So they're different. The soul is transcendental, is in other words. This is one of the four arguments. We're going to hear them a few times. Second argument is the distinction that proceeds from the seer and the seen. They're not totally different, but it's a distinction for sake of analysis. And the metaphor is used to compare the soul that's unchanging to the life air that's unchanging as changes of body change. The life air doesn't change even within this life and on to the next life. We'll hear that in text coming up. Text number 39. Just a bit, we're going to see that one. So the soul and prana are compared one to another. Then we saw this nice image of our meditator friend. And Jiva Goswami says what Srimad Bhagavatam is doing, it's a commentary on Vedanta Sutra by the author of Vedanta Sutra, Vyas. And these verses, 38, 39, 40, are explaining a Vedic process of knowledge. By understanding the part, we can then understand the whole, the quality of the whole. So it's a strategy. And that comes from, it's explaining Vedanta Sutra, this aphorism that's here. And the way the Vedanta Sutra is constructed by Vyas, Vedanta Sutra is summarizing the vastness of the Vedas. So there's a particular Chandogya Upanishad verse that it's referring to, just in a sutra form. I find this like brilliant. Anyway, here's the nice image. This is a city called Brahmapura, the city of Brahman. And within that city, there's this subtle lotus. And within the lotus, there's the sky. And there's something within the sky. That's what the Chandogya Upanishad verse says. In the city of Brahman, that's that background city that we saw, is a subtle residence in the form of a lotus. Subtle residence in the form of a lotus. Within the residence is a subtle sky. You should find out what is within the subtle sky. It's like a riddle, right? Well, let's unpack. Well, we'll take Jiva Goswami's help to unpack the riddle. Here's our friend, the meditator, again. And as he's getting absorbed in his meditation, this subtle lotus appears. And within the subtle lotus, super soul appears. That's when he becomes really fixed in his meditation. And here's the meaning. The city of Brahman, it's Brahmapura in Chandogya Upanishad, that's the body of the meditator. And then as he becomes absorbed in his meditation, he can perceive, he may perceive, a lotus-shaped residence within the body, and that's the heart. And that heart just isn't just like, you know, the physical muscle. It's the seat of consciousness. That's where the jiva is. Within that residence is the super soul, who is metaphorically called the sky, which accommodates everything in the universe. So super soul, it's this function, as we heard earlier. It's the upadhi, or the voluntarily accepted delimiting feature, that rather than showing the fullness of Krishna in the spiritual world, he accepts the position of regulating and overseeing material nature. So that, and material nature means everything within the universe. So the Chandogya Upanishad is inviting the reader of the Chandogya Upanishad to meditate on super soul. And to do that, you have to acknowledge you're a conscious being, then there's something you can be conscious of. First the body, then the heart, the seat of consciousness, and then this sky that contains everything. You know, Akash again. It's very similar to chapter 9, Bhagavad Gita. Everything is within Krishna and everything is not within Krishna. Behold my mystic opulence. Very similar. But it doesn't stop there. If the meditator continues, so it's, there's knowledge, there's contemplation that leads to bhakti. If you perform it properly under proper guidance. So there's the heart, that subtle lotus, and within that subtle lotus, there's this metaphorical sky or super soul. So the sky within the lotus of the heart is the same Supreme Lord who, with his all-pervading energies, creates and maintains the entire universe. But keep going with your meditation, and one can then recognize the space is very small. But that small space is filled with the unlimited Supreme, who has very kindly accompanied the living entity through his whole sojourn of material existence. Even away, I'm out of here, I'm leaving you. So there. He's so kind, he doesn't reject us, he hides himself within the heart to guide us through that sojourn. And then, whoops. Within the Supreme Lord as Super Soul, then continue with the meditation process and you start to understand about the person, the qualities, like we've mentioned one, kindness. And more qualities and more qualities and more qualities. Through the process of meditation. It's not just abstract, it's localized on that form of the Supreme within the heart. And continue. as these qualities gradually appear within himself with the progress of his self-realization. That means by contemplating Supersoul, those qualities of Supersoul through association awaken those qualities in you. Transcendental qualities. Through this one act of contemplating Paramatma. And then the spirit soul in his pure heart, sanctified by these qualities, can find the original source. The source of all Paramatmas. And the source of everything. That's the Bhagavan feature. Purified of all material desires, which comes in the prema stage, he naturally encounters the pure happiness of desiring to satisfy the Supreme, the desire to be engaged in service. Bhakti awakens by this process step by step. It can be accelerated by hearing from those that have that understanding or that consciousness, bhakti consciousness. And by that hearing, bhakti awakens, the desire to be in service to that original Supreme. Upon leaving his present body, such a factually liberated soul can at once join the Supreme in his personal kingdom, never to return to material. When such souls reach the spiritual realm, they attain their eternal spiritual bodies. Swarup, the spiritual form, no more material form, which has been forgotten. So, what, step back. What's going disclosing, and what is Jiva Goswami helping us to understand? There's this eternal Vedas. Part of it is this Chandogya Upanishad that's teaching us how to connect again with Krishna. But it's kind of like a riddle, but who can figure it out? So then, Vedanta Sutra summarizes it, Srimad Bhagavatam explains it, and Lord Chaitanya threw this yesterday. Very simple process. And Jiva Goswami, by the kind assistance of Rupa Goswami and Gopal Bhatta, he's now disclosing how Srimad Bhagavatam explains this abhideya, or the process of reaching the goal, prayojana, love for Krishna, step by step. So that's what we're undertaking. About more information. There's a lot of information. And it's not about more information. It's not about contemplating that information and contemplating in meditation what the information is about. It includes that also, but it's meant to, through that process, awaken bhakti. That's the abhideya, the means of. That's what we're here for. That's why this is being presented by Jiva Goswami and those who he's representing. That's what Srimad Bhagavatam is. So we're interested in it. Very interested in it. And it if one hears it properly, it's consciousness transforming. From ordinary into the transcendental realm, into the stage of desiring to serve, not just regulations, but desiring to serve Krishna, and coming to the stage of spontaneous attraction for Krishna, and the mature stage, feelings of transcendental love manifest through practical activity. So it doesn't mean you put your life on hold and do this instead. You do this as an expression of your devotion to Krishna, because the whole show, the whole cosmic manifestation, is for that purpose, to give us an opportunity to be engaged in a service by awakening that internal consciousness. Isn't it nice? That's very nice. So now, we've covered texts 50, 51, 52, 53. Little summary of what we've covered so far, and we're ready for the final two verses of this section. There's three verses. So far, we've only touched on one. 30. Messages of Canto 11 teach us that there are four pervasive reasons why recognizing the spirit soul's inherent qualities, eternal, unchanging, pure consciousness, and so forth, show how it is distinct from the body and from the material world. Consciousness not, we're not against the idea of being in the moment. Like, you know, be conscious of Krishna, please. Now, and then the next moment, and the next moment, and life is but a series of moments. But be conscious of Krishna. And that means there's the seer and there's the seen. And even we see things. When we see things, see Krishna as the substratum. At least that's the goal, to come to that position. And then this process that we're being guided by Jiva Goswami and Vyasadeva, the author of the Bhagavatam. It's this microcosm or Vyasti perspective helping us understand the absolute. Which going Vastava or Vastava Vastu. The absolute and the connection of all things with the absolute. That's the little summary of what we've been hearing by the kindness of Jiva Goswami. So that's the end of our little review. And now we're ready for just two more verses. And the path that we're moving on is the microcosm helps us understand the macro. The understanding the living entity helps us understand the supreme, because the living entity is part of the supreme, like a drop of water to the ocean, or a particle of gold from a gold mine. Qualitatively one, quantitatively different. The next verse from the 11th canto is still addressing, because Jiva Goswami is giving these verses that respond to the Buddhist view that consciousness is momentary only. Kshanak Vijnana Vad. Momentary consciousness. So consciousness is not momentary. It's constant. In consciousness of yellowness, consciousness is constant. So it's a very interesting approach. You have to be, like, put your antenna up. Try to understand 11th canto, chapter 2, text 39. How to perceive the changeless soul when the mind, senses, and false ego dissolve. In other words, supposing you're a Shankara follower, supposing you're a Buddhist, you would say, depending upon your, you know, the school that you came from, there's no such thing as these other things. The Shankaras say it's an upadhi, and the Buddhas say it doesn't exist. So, there, according to the Vedic paradigm, there are different stages of consciousness. There's awake, there's sleep but dreaming, and there's deep sleep. and there's Sanskrit terms for each of them. We'll hear them in the course of this text 54. So in that deep sleep condition, like, you know, the bottom of the deep sleep is anesthesia. Anyone had an operation where you put under anesthesia? Some. So when you're under anesthesia, what happens? Besides they can cut you open and you don't feel anything, what happens with time? It's Zippo. Zippo. Or just anecdotal. Some of you may know Pritrashrava and Donna Kelly, very nice devotees. So Pritrashrava had this lump in his throat. And it was benign, it wasn't malignant, it wasn't cancer, it didn't grow, but so he was trying natural this and natural that, and it didn't grow, and it was very austere. But then it started to grow after some years of all of that. So he finally resigned himself. I have to have an operation, remove that thing. So under anesthesia, they removed the thing. But while under anesthesia, he swallowed blood. So when the anesthesia wore off, or started to wear off, he started to cough. So then they had to more anesthesia, and then pump out the blood from his, wherever it went to, lungs or something. And then it wore off. So I discussed this with him. He said it was like no time had passed. He looked at the clock and some, whatever the number of hours was, 8 hours or some number of hours. He didn't feel that any time had passed. Time stopped. In that state of deep sleep, under anesthesia, there's no sense of time. And there's no sense of senses, mind, and false ego operating. They're dormant because time is withdrawn by that anesthetized state of consciousness. Or it's as if time is withdrawn. Time is passing. For the rest of the people in the room, time is passing. But for the person that's in that deep sleep state, time isn't operating and these subtle factors are not operating. Then, you know, go a little bit beyond the anesthesia state, and then there's, according to the Vedic paradigm, there's a condition of sleep that's very similar, where you're not dreaming, but you're not existing, just the senses are not operating. During sleep, with dreaming, the mind is operating, all the senses are inert. But the mind is operating, and also the sense of false ego is operating because you think you're in the dream. Although it may be a totally different body than the one that you're actually in. In the mind, which is operating, the false ego is also operating. It's me in the dream. Then there's this other, it's called susupti, this deep sleep where there's no dreaming. And according to the Vedic paradigm, false ego in the mind, they also are withdrawn, just like time is withdrawn. There's no sense of passage of time. And the senses are not operating, the mind is not operating, false ego is not operating. But conscious entity is still there. So the verse that we're going to see in just a moment addresses that experience. That's what text 39 says. What's it like? How to perceive the changeless soul when these faculties, mind, intelligence, and, senses, mind, and false ego are not operating? Because normally we perceive things through the senses, or maybe through the mind. But when they're not operating, doesn't everything stop? That's the goal of the impersonalists. Just stop. Or the voidist, just nothing. Enter into a state of nothingness. And then you don't have momentary consciousness anymore. You don't have consciousness. Because consciousness is only this momentary thing. That's their view. Well, Srimad Bhagavatam doesn't agree with that. Here's text 39, and just going to read the translation. The spirit soul, which we heard from the previous verses, doesn't born, doesn't die, unchanging, so forth, like chapter 2 Bhagavad Gita. The spirit soul is born, receives a body, in many different species of life within the material world. Then there's four ways that birth takes place. Some are born from eggs, others from embryos, others from seeds of plants and trees, and others from perspiration. Four different entries into getting a material body. But in all species of life, the prana or vital air remains unchanging and follows the spirit soul from one body to another. Now, I didn't know that till I read this verse. But it's a comparison. As the soul doesn't change, prana doesn't change. The outside changes due to the modes of nature, guna and karma. The outside changes, even during our present life and from this life to the next life. But prana doesn't change and the jiva doesn't change. Consciousness changes because of the covering, an identification with the covering. The spirit soul is eternally the same despite its material condition of life. We have practical experience of this. When we are absorbed in deep sleep without dreaming, the material senses become inactive, and even the mind and false ego are merged into a dormant condition. They don't go out of existence. They just go to sleep. They're not operating. They're suspended or dormant. But although the senses, mind, and false ego are inactive, one remembers upon waking that he, the soul, was peacefully sleeping. So, there's so many different species of life. There's a very accurate, precise number within the Bhagavatam, 8,400,000 species of life, and how many of this species and how many of that species. So now, Jiva Goswami is going to analyze what's being said. This is an image to show someone who is breathing, and there's life air, the incoming and outgoing air. So how does this help us understand the changelessness of the soul? Very simple, two parts, by comparing something to another something. First, the changelessness of life air or prana is given or stated. In all species of life, the prana or vital air remains unchanging. And it follows the spirit soul from one body to another. Again, I'm not familiar with this science of prana, but that's what the science of prana is stated in the Vedas. It's the life air. The air of life, prana. We require prana. And when one becomes weak physically, prana becomes weak. Or when prana becomes weak physically, we become weak. When prana is vital, we feel energy. It's life air. And so part of the yoga system is strengthened by drilling the life air, by pranayama. Then you feel invigorated and energized and clarity of thought and strong mind and all of those desirable things. Now, what's the purpose of all of that? Well, if you're a materialist, it's so you feel better. And if you're a spiritualist, it will help you achieve the purpose of life. Become fixed upon the Supreme Person. So, as prana is explained, the comparison is being made to the changelessness of the soul. Now, there's these three states of consciousness. One, when the soul is awake, it seems to be undergoing changes. That's because the covering is undergoing changes. And when the senses are asleep yet dreaming, the ego retains sensory impressions. Sensory impressions means, like, supposing it's really cold, or supposing it's really hot, or supposing in your dream there is a tiger and you feel fear and you're perspiring and you call out, ah, and you wake up and there was no tiger. Although your heart is palpitating and you're feeling, you know, the adrenal system has got activated because it was going on in the mind. But this verse is saying, when one is in deep sleep and the senses and the ego are temporarily merged in dissolution, the changeless soul remains unchanged. Well, how do we know that? We know that because when the seat of tainted consciousness, the subtle body, is unmanifest, withdrawn, no upadis remain to impose changes upon the soul. Remember that word, upadis. Limiting impositions. So the gross body and the subtle body are upadis. And bhakti, a definition of bhakti, is sarva upadi vinirmuktam. Become free from those limitations. It's not who you are. Okay, watch the graphics on the left side here. There's this person remembering himself. He's deep asleep. And then slowly he starts to wake up. Hey. So there's fellow has a doubt. Wait a minute. If everything dissolves, including the false ego, nothing remains. That's if you don't accept there's an eternal conscious soul. So how then is the soul still in his steady position? That's the doubting person. So Jiva Goswami says this verse answers that doubt. We have remembrance of this. And there's the Sanskrit. Tat anusmritir naha. Smritir means remember. Anusmritir naha. We remember. As awake observers, we remember this individual soul, the witness of deep sleep. I slept comfortably for so long and wasn't aware of anything. Because it's like conventional. Did you sleep well last night? Oh, I slept very well. No, my sleep was disturbed. I kept waking up. I had good sleep. How did you know you had good sleep? Well, because everything was shut down. This verse of the Bhagavatam and their Shruti mantras. Shruti mantras means, you know, Upanishads say the same thing. That is, even when you're in this deep sleep, you're conscious of yourself. You're not conscious of things because the senses, the mind, and false ego are inoperative. But you're not conscious. Okay? Therefore, since nothing can be remembered if not experienced before, the soul had such an experience in deep sleep. Although, because the soul was then out of contact with sense objects, the experience was indistinct. That's the argument of Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 11, that's explaining something that the Upanishads say, because that's what the Bhagavatam is. It's a commentary on Vedanta Sutra, which is a summarization of all the Vedas. Now, is it possible to get this realization by mechanical method? And the answer is no. The presence of the soul cannot be known by speculation, the mind, or by refinement of the senses, electron microscopes, or any other sensory methodology. It's beyond the range of the mind and the senses. It's in this transcendental realm. So how are we supposed to know about it? Well, we can know about it through another means, shabda praman. Exactly what the pramana khanda section, you know, the last Thanksgiving discussion was about. You can't know transcendental things through these limited means. You have to have shabda praman. But if you follow it, then you can, exactly as Krishna says in chapter 9, pratyaksha avagamam dharmyam, you can directly perceive, not through the senses nor through the mind, but by transcendental realization. What's that mean? Just like the comparison is given in the Bhagavatam, just like if you've been fasting, probably all of us have had that experience of voluntary or involuntary fasting. And what happens when you fast? You feel weak. You feel some fatigue. Likely you'll feel some hunger. So what happens when you start breaking the fast? You feel strength. You feel your hunger is subsiding. And you feel satisfied. At a certain point, somebody may say, do you want some more of this and that? And you say, no, I'm full. Somebody doesn't have to tell you, now you are full. Repeat after me. Yes, now I'm full. You can, by experience, you can tell them, oh, thank you, I'm full. Similarly, by this sound vibration process of hearing Srimad Bhagavatam and gradually awakening the vyasti of the microcosm understanding and progressively understanding the Supreme, the connection with the Supreme, somebody doesn't have to tell you. See, I'm paraphrasing a very wonderful verse from the Bhagavatam that says, bhakti awakens from the process of hearing. Para isha anubhav. Anubhav means feelings. You have feelings for that Supreme. And viraktir anyatracha. You feel detachment from other things. It's something you experience. It's not something somebody has to tell you. Now you're feeling detachment. Now you're feeling, repeat after me, now you're feeling that you want to serve Krishna. No, it's not something like that. It's something that's, as consciousness awakens, it's like that. Just from hearing, done properly. Therefore, the presence of the soul can be known only by this transcendental sound vibration method. And, as I said yesterday, this would make a fantastic college course. You know, spiritual psychology. How does it really work? On the authority of Shabda. This is a science of psychology, and it has different parts. Here, just two are identified. The soul, the conscious self, remains unchanging while passing from one body to another. That's, you know, during this lifetime or after this lifetime into the next lifetime. The soul is unchanging. And the different experiences of that unchanging soul depends upon the body that it's in. And the type of senses, or the same thing, another soul with a different set of senses says it's not nice. One man's food is another man's poison. And then even during one lifetime, we may not like something and then later we like something. you know, you'll cultivate a taste for something. They probably sell them anymore, but cigarettes that the brand name was Cool. Prabhupada said they're smoking a fire stick and they call it Cool. And you know, the first time people smoke, they just cough and cough because it's foreign, but then they develop a taste for it and they become addicted. To misery. You can't do without it. You can't do without it. Very sad. Very sad. So, varieties of experience the soul undergoes within a single body. We're gonna cross the finish line real soon. Because this is now building argument number three and then our, so the jiva in material existence is covered first by a subtle body, ego, intelligence, and mind, and then the outward, gross body. During a typical day, every living being passes in and out of these following three basic psychological states. And you've heard them already. Here's the Sanskrit phrase, external wakefulness, jagara. So the little illustration on the left is different people doing different things in the state of wakefulness. So the explanation is the senses are active. And when the senses are active, they're contacting the external world and the impressions are made within the mind. And then attention, awareness pays more attention to this than to that. Specific attention, the blue and the yellow kind of example. Through further connection with the intelligence and ego, this input reaches the jiva, the actual seat of consciousness, in this complex, subtle mechanism. So consciousness extends out through the senses. That's if they're working properly. If empowered by the demigods, then the machine part's not broken. Then you can see something, although it's distant. So consciousness is extending out. And then the information comes back in and contacts the soul. That's this jagra or external wakefulness. Then the second one is called supti or dreaming. So there's the fellow dreaming. And he's lying in bed, but in his mind, in the dream, is something. The external senses are inactive, but the mind, which, though lacking input from the physical world, is still active, and the mind creates dreams. Prabhupada explains that dreams are made up of impressions of something you experienced. Or say it the other way. You cannot experience in your dream something that you haven't experienced through your senses. He gives the example. Supposing in your dream, you dream of a golden mountain. There's no such thing, golden mountain. But in your experience, you experience gold and you experience a mountain, you synthesize them together and you dream of a golden mountain. Because you can't dream of something unless you've experienced it with your senses. That's what the mind does. It processes sensory information, sensory data. And then there's this other one. The dreamless deep sleep. So susupti. Jagra, supti, and susupti. And there's our fellow deep sleep. No dream. And in this, all three components of the subtle body become dormant, just as the gross body is zonked out, dormant. So that's this deep sleep state. And according to not only this Bhagavatam verse, but Shruti mantras, I didn't quote them, but they're in the commentary, they say the same thing. The soul is present and conscious in deep sleep. The soul is present, eternal, and conscious. Even there's nothing registering. How do we know that? Practically speaking, oh, I slept well. And if you're not sleeping well, it's because you're worried or bothered or too much dreaming. I'll just share this. I've had the experience of going to Ayurvedic clinic, and I took Panchakarma treatment. Panchakarma is a kind of cleanse procedure. And the principle of it is to, by this, that, and the other thing, remove the toxins from the body, send them to the colon, and then purgation. Going through that experience, and I've shared with others that have been through that experience, there's this thing of endless, meaningless dreams. You're not sleeping well at all. It's just like nonstop. It's just part of the cleansing process, because the toxins are stored within the body are being eliminated. And so those are impressions that are being eliminated along with the physical aspect, the toxins. They're being eliminated from the body. And then when it's all over, you can rest well. Anyway. Next. Although he is not in touch with any external sensations or concrete memories or dreams even, he continues to witness his own existence. It is said that he perceives, this is interesting, a kind of pleasure in deep sleep, a mild, temporary version of Brahmananda, the bliss known after liberation from material bondage. And that liberation after material bondage is you're no longer identifying with the covering. There's still a covering. But those who are in this Brahmananda state, they're not identifying with the covering. And there's a happiness with that. Relief from misidentification with the covering. But bhakti goes way beyond that relief. Prabhupada's expression is, if you bang your head against a wall, it hurts. And when you stop, Brahmananda. So this explanation is it's a mild Brahmananda, but temporary. Unfortunately, he still has desires for material enjoyment, and therefore the soul leaves that state and wakes up again. It's desire, specifically desire separate from our loving relationship with the Supreme. It keeps driving us to the next and the next and the next and the next state of foolishness and misery. So back to text 38. There's this term, upalabdhi matra. Upalabdhi matra. It's a Vedic statement. It's not only in the Bhagavatam. Mayavad philosophy insists that this transcendental nature, or upalabdhi matra, or pure consciousness, disallows the separate presence of knower, noble objects, and the process of knowledge. Their argument goes, since Brahman is pure awareness, Brahman cannot be a subject possessing specific awareness. That's like, you know, presupposition. All there is Brahman, and there isn't anything else. So it can't be aware of something else because all there is Brahman. Called circular reasoning. Should I say it again? They disallow knowledge of something, you know, the seer and the seen, because the presupposition, the predisposition is there's only one thing. That's Brahman. So you can't be aware of something, because then that contradicts Maiva doctrine. So they disallow it. What are you? You're Upalabdhi Matram. That's all. That's all that is. You're pure consciousness. That's it. And he cannot be a person. Because then there's person, then there's individual, and then there's diversity. You can't have diversity because all there is Brahman, and so there's, you're not a person either. And Krishna's not a person either. Because all there is Upalabdhi Matra. But common experience tells us that the sources of illumination reveal all kinds of objects, including themselves. There's no meaning to pure illumination, which doesn't reveal anything. And when there is no special reason for its being hidden, a source of light usually shows itself as well. Not only lighting up other things, it shows itself. Thus, when the conscious self is in deep sleep, it is said that he doesn't see anything because there's nothing for him to see, not because there's no seer. So this is argument two, seer and seen. Conclusion. The soul, although Upalabdhi Matram, pure consciousness, pure awareness, is itself an object of its own awareness, as was just demonstrated. Just as, by the sleeping, deep sleep with no dreaming. Just as luminous bodies like the sun are objects revealed by their own light. So the Shruti mantras, this is the Upanishads, therefore say, it is true that the soul during deep sleep does not see, or rather that although seeing, he does not see externally visible objects. To remove the seer's vision altogether is impossible. This is the third argument, which proceeds from the distinction between witness and witnessed, which is quite similar to, but subtly different from seer and seen. In this case, it's in deep sleep. There's nothing seen, but there's the witness of that experience of deep sleep. So the witness and the witnessed. That's what text 39 is showing. And the fourth argument is from text 40. Now the book, the Tattvasandarbha book, doesn't quote it, but we're going to because it's text 40. This, the fourth argument, is found in the next verse, which you're going to see next slide. A fourth argument is implied by the distinction between being unhappy and being a reservoir of ecstatic love. Well, let's take a look at text 40. Here's text 40. Hopefully. There we go. Without all the Sanskrit. When one seriously engages in devotional service of the personality of Godhead, that's all of you, otherwise Sunday morning you'd be somewhere else. Fixing the Lord's lotus feet within one's heart as the only goal of life, well, we're working on it. One can destroy the innumerable impure desires lodged within the heart as a result of one's previous fruitive work within the three modes of nature. Guna and karma gives us a body, and it's stored within the body, and the body is an instrument to fulfill those desires. That's the covering, that's the contamination conditioning, but the bhakti process, this meditating on the Lord's lotus feet and hearing the message of Srimad Bhagavatam, etc., removes that, so it restores the natural state instead of the suffering state. When the heart is thus purified, one can directly perceive both the Supreme Lord and oneself as transcendental entities, which is what Vyasa's realization was. Thus, one becomes perfect in spiritual understanding through direct experience. Bhagavad Gita chapter 9. Pratyaksha. It happens. Pratyaksha. Direct experience of both oneself and the Supreme. Not just being peaceful or, you know, the roar of banging your head against the wall subsides. It's the positive experience of love in the relationship with the Supreme Person who has form and name and qualities and activities and abode and all attractiveness. Nations of that ecstatic love. Udipan, in the language of Rupa Goswami. Stimulations of ecstatic love. Just as one can directly experience the sunshine through normal healthy vision. So just as we, in awake consciousness, experience sunshine, through sunshine, the presence of the sun, we can, and the Supreme in our relationship with Him, and eternally be situated like that. Okay, that was the end of 54. 55 is quick. It's just a review. Here are these four arguments restated. He's a lawyer. He's built his case. He's now giving his closing arguments. Here's the four. In a positive sense, if it's this, then it's not that. Or in the negative sense, that it's not this, then it allows that, both positive and negative. It's just a system of Sanskrit again. So, according to these three verses, Jiva Goswami is stating there are four pervasive reasons why the spirit soul should be recognized as distinct from the body and from the material world. And then the inference is, so also with the Supreme. So here we go. This is review. And then we're done. The first argument or presentation is, from what comes and goes, and what is the ultimate ground of both coming and going? So there's the soul is extending consciousness and receiving information, and then there's the things that are changing, and they're distinct, the transcendental nature of the soul, the unchanging nature of the soul. The second is the distinction between the seer and the seen. We recall that. The yellow and the blue, what the mind does, what the senses acknowledge is different than the seat of consciousness itself. And the third is this witness and witnessed, the sleeping state without dreaming. We're still the witness of that. Although we're not witnessing other things, we're witnessing that. I slept well. I wasn't disturbed by bad thoughts or bad dreams or anything. And so that's a negative statement that infers the positive. We're aware of what that was because we can't attest to something that we didn't experience. And then this fourth one is reawakening our true happiness when we were in an unhappy state. Although it's our nature to be in a happy state. So those are the four arguments. Then a few other messages. The material body and its environment keep changing. One thing constant about material nature is always changing. And they're limited. Everything of the material world is limited. The situation of the material body and its environment is inconstant. The future of neither is even certain, or should be ever certain, I think. As long as one's attention is directed outward, you know, what we do normally, one's body and the external world are the only objects of perception. Thus, the world one witnesses in ordinary life is a limited picture, comprehending only the inert matter of one's own mind and body, plus other living bodies and objects. That's, you know, normal consciousness, awake, conditioned consciousness. In contrast to these material conditions, the spirit soul persists unchanged, carried from one gross body to another by the subtle body. The soul is conscious, whereas the mind, body, and the outside world are not. That's this distinction. This is the first argument, this transcendental nature of the soul. Although he ordinarily pays attention only to externals, he can, with some introspection, notice himself as the constant witness. He then feels somehow alien in his body and in the world because he misses his natural condition of pure happiness. Nice little graphic. So going through all these transformations, somebody, the rare soul, may wake up and ask these fundamental questions. Who am I really? These distinguishing characteristics of the soul are knowable by the scientific method of self-realization. It's a science of reproducible again and again, the experiment, observation, conclusion kind of thing. Self-realization is not mysterious, it's a science. People generally don't follow it, but it's reproducible again and again and again. It is a well-defined procedure, verifiable by experiment. One need only be prepared to perform the experiment on oneself and carefully follow the methodology prescribed. And Shastra, don't whimsically make up something. That's where I started. This is a very ancient and traditional process. It's a science, a spiritual science. Like when I became interested in Krishna consciousness, my mother and father got a little concerned. And then when I moved into a temple, I didn't continue on in my medical career. I just went and moved into an ashram. They told me later, we thought, he's young, he's idealistic, he'll get over it. And then when I didn't get over it, they went through the next change. What is this thing? They told me. We checked it out. And we found it's authentic. We don't understand it, but we know it's a very ancient tradition. It's following a very ancient tradition. It's authentic. It's genuine. So at least he's in safe zone. But maybe he'll get over it. And then when I didn't get over it, they're, you know, nice liberal parents saying, as long as you're happy, we're happy. You know, the subtext is, what would make us happy is you go complete your studies and you get a career and you get married and you have children, we have grandchildren, you know, do what everybody else normally does. That's what we'd like. But if you're happy, we're happy. And then the final stage, I was just like continuing on with Krishna consciousness. They were going through all these changes. The final one was, we're proud of you. There was some material part to what they were proud of. You know, you're successful in this organization. You didn't become a doctor, but you became, you know, a somebody in the organization. So we're proud of you. But, you know, you're true to your values. They were proud of that. You hold values and you live according to your values. Even it's like not supported by the mainstream of society. You have values, you live by your values. We're proud of you. Not so easy for everybody. Sometimes it's a little more difficult from family and friends and relatives, and they have their expectations and you don't meet their expectations, and they don't like it. And they have different ways of letting you know they don't like it. But if you follow the process, you make the experiment and follow according to the authentic, genuine, not you make it up as you go along, I feel like this, now I feel like that. You know, that's not the way to experiment. The experiment is take something genuine. That's the recommendation of the Vedas in any case. And then the results will be self-evident. You know, like from the eating process, your hunger subsides, you feel strength, and you feel satisfied. The results will be self-evident. The conditioned soul will gradually perceive what he is. First, in a general way, and then in a specific and personal relationship with the Supreme Self. So there we have it. That's the verses 38, 39, 40. Taking a look at the individual soul in its sojourn towards the Supreme Soul, giving us some indication of the Supreme Soul by that process. Vyasti, the microcosm to the macrocosm. Okay, so we finished that second of three sections, which is, what is this message of Srimad Bhagavatam? It's our primary means of validating or understanding transcendence. What's the message of Srimad Bhagavatam? So we just follow this Vyasti and Samasti, or microcosm, macrocosm method, to understand what the Srimad Bhagavatam's message is. And after breakfast, when we resume, we'll finish the final section. Is there any discussion? Yeah. Microphone?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. I had some doubt about the final summary, the 4 points. The second and third point seems to be almost similar.
They're very similar. The difference between the third one and the second one is when you're asleep without dreaming, you're still a witness of that. Although there's not objects that you're witnessing.
Okay.
That's the distinction.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Hare Krishna, Maharaj. Thank you very much. Maharaj, the science of self-realization, the process, is more of understanding the part and then perceiving the whole, or vice versa?
It's both. It's reciprocal. The process is the sadhana, what you do. But the purpose of the what you do is to connect with the Supreme. So it's both understand who you are and understand the Supreme. Here's Prabhupada answering your question. God realization and self-realization, they occur simultaneously, like the rising of the sun in the morning. When it's night, you can have a mirror and you can't see yourself because it's night. But when the sun rises, you can see the sun and you can see yourself simultaneously. It's both. It's a relationship. So it's both. Progressively. Next.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. Thank you so much for a wonderful class. Maharaj, I have a question and an extension of the question. My first question is, when you showed that meditator and he's realizing a city and then subtle lotus flower and a subtle sky.
Isn't that nice?
Yes, that's very...
I like that.
But what is the process that meditator is following? Is that meditator following the process we follow, the chanting, japa, devotion?
Yeah. The form that we follow is, as you said, in other ages, dhyan is the form, just like in Satya Yuga. Kapiladev gave his teaching, but the meditation process leads to bhakti. And it's there, right within his teachings. It's just the form is different. The goal is the same. And the medium of awakening bhakti is the same. The form for us is different. It's just made really simple. Even a child can do, as Prabhupada would say.
The question is that when Jiva Goswami is saying about devotional service and then the goal is to fix the lotus feet of the Lord in the heart.
Yes.
How do we do that? Do we think
chant.
That, okay, now I am...
chant and hear. That's how we do it. You know, and as refinement of the senses and the mind and the intelligence take place, we become attached to Krishna, and the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the literary form of Krishna, and that fixes the lotus feet in the heart. That fixing lotus feet in the heart, in one sense, can mean attached to being in service. That's the lotus feet. That's what you do. Externally, and internally it's the mood of being in service in whatever it is that you do. That's fixing the lotus feet of the Lord in the heart. And in course of time, the form of the Lord, nama, rupa, guna, lila, they unfold. That's what it means.
Okay. So just to make sure that I understood it correctly.
The mood of service, just focus on the mood of service, that's the lotus feet. Fixing the lotus feet of the Lord in the heart means, in practical terms, the mood of humble service unto Krishna and Krishna's. Yeah, that's the meaning.
Thank you, Guru Maharaj, for taking the time to give us this clarity, which is so rare to find in this world. I have actually five questions.
Five questions.
I don't know, maybe I can ask one or two and then...
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. In the description of the inactive or the susupti stage where...
Speak slowly and clearly, please.
Okay.
Your sentences go like this. And then there's a pause. And then it's slowly. And then it's really fast. It's hard for me to hear. Slowly and clearly, please.
So in the description of the deep sleep condition, it was mentioned about the three things going into the inactive state.
Yes.
Senses, mind, and ego. So is the intelligence purposefully...
I thought you would ask that question. And sure enough, you asked the question. Yeah, it also goes to sleep.
Okay.
It's not active. It's not analyzing anything. Next.
This is coming from yesterday's class.
Okay.
It was mentioned that Brahman, the essence of Brahman is bliss. And we also hear...
The essence of Brahman is sat. existence. And then the question arises, well, wait a minute, the tattva of existence implies bliss. So there's a modest bliss within Brahman. The millions of times multiplied is not equal to a drop of the happiness of love for Krishna.
Okay.
Go ahead, go to your third question. They were easy.
That you showed, it was mentioned that the jiva soul is present everywhere at all times, and I probably did not
that means, hear. It means within the body, the soul is present by consciousness. The soul is present within the body. It's like a universe. Like, you know, the solar system. The sunshine is everywhere present. So given the soul is both conscious and consciousness, the soul is everywhere present by consciousness within the body. It's not unlimited consciousness, it's not the supreme. But within the body, within the universe of the body, the soul is everywhere present.
I was just confused by the at all times. Why is that at all times?
Why not? The soul is eternal. It doesn't come into being, go out of being. It's at all times. And if it gets transferred to another body, then it's still conscious at all times, everywhere. Wherever its consciousness extends to, within the parameters of that universe of body, gross and subtle.
Okay.
Go ahead, keep going.
To my
speak slowly.
Other question about, because I did not attend the first few classes, I later on only heard. Just wanted to understand better when we say that the soul is conscious as well as consciousness.
I don't mind going over that again.
It's
very simple. We showed a slide of a lamp, like a Diwali lamp in a clay cup. And there's a little wick sticking up, cotton wick, and it's burning. And so it's luminous. But then in the background is a wall, and the effulgence of that little lamp is illuminating the wall and whatever else is nearby. So just as fire is luminous and illuminates other things, the soul similarly is conscious and consciousness. And consciousness can become contaminated by the upadis, gross and subtle. But it's consciousness and conscious. So there is the process of knowledge, of becoming aware of things, which both Mayavadis and impersonalists say no. Because there's a fundamental assumption. You can't have two things. You know, seer and then seen? No good. That means there's more than one thing. You can't have it. So you just like, there's no consciousness. There's only conscious. Or pure conscious Brahman. There's no process of knowledge and objects of knowledge, even knowing oneself. It's really Mayavada. I mean, it's voidism. Mayavada doctrine is simply covered voidism, covered Buddhism. Exactly as as Lord Shiva says to Parvati. Go ahead. Last one.
So I was trying to clarify the difference between the first argument and the second argument, because in the first argument...
They're similar, but they're not the same. The first argument is the soul is transcendental and thus is conscious, and objects that are not conscious, the souls can be conscious of other souls, but conscious of the changing consciousness is due to the changingness of matter. not the changingness of the soul. The soul is transcendental. And it's not a totally distinct, but the subtle difference of the number two is there is the seer and there is the seen, which impersonalists deny. There isn't. Voidists deny.
But the seer is exactly the same as the point from which the consciousness extends.
You can see the connection. You can also see, hopefully, the distinction. There is certainly a connection between the two. There's a distinction between the two. Focus on the distinction, not the sameness. It's subtle, but there's a distinction. One is permanent and unchanging and conscious. The other is ever-changing and impermanent. They're different. Then another is the seen and the seer. They're related, but it's a distinct point.
And my last...
He's a college professor. What can you do? PhD fellows get some special exemption. Go ahead.
I also want to understand the significance of the power of the senses. What does it actually mean?
What does it actually mean as opposed to what doesn't it actually mean?
Because when we were talking about it's the power of senses that is actually mattering for bringing that distinction.
Well, if you're happy with leaving out the word power, then maybe it's easier. But senses do have power. So it's just there's the capacity... Maybe use that word, the capacity of the senses. Consciousness is extended out through the senses. So there's a power of the senses that let's just say, this gets into this very complicated discussion at the end that I'm not even going to go over, the adiyanvika, adidaivika, adibhautika. But you can have an eye. That machine part is good, but it requires the empowerment of the demigods to make it work. The power of the demigods removed, the eye can't see, the legs can't walk, and so on. The power of locomotion is not just within the senses. There's an empowerment that comes from the empowerment giver. But the empowerment giver can't give that power without the sanction of the Supreme. So the power of the senses extends hearing, seeing, smelling into the world outside. So it's not just the senses, it's the power of the senses, the capacity of the sense to function, the seeing capacity, etc. So because that third argument is because of the power of the senses, the capacity of the ear to hear and the eye to see and the tongue to taste and so forth. The change of sweetness and bitterness and sourness and so forth for taste doesn't change of consciousness. It's the power of the sense to reach out into the energy out there and the difference of consciousness is due to the power of the senses contacting objects. But consciousness doesn't change. Unchanging. The essence of consciousness doesn't change. Depending upon the power of the senses, it will perceive something. A dog can smell things we can't smell. Although we also have a nose. He has a certain power of the sense because of the covering, the upadhi, the gross and subtle covering.
Okay, thank you.
Anything over here? Yes, 1, 2. Come out over to the other side and we're done. Breakfast time.
Thank you, Maharaj. My question has two parts. I want to clarify that devotees also lives in the present moment, but we add Krishna into that moment.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. When you're chanting, you should be attentive to the mantra that you're presently chanting. Not the one that you didn't chant so nicely before, the one you're expecting that soon I'm going to chant nicely. You're in the moment of the name with Krishna at the center.
So another question is, does the material mind still act up on a person when he is in the moment, he is live in the present moment? Does the material mind still function?
Well, it depends if what the mind is paying attention to. Meaning, one may be paying attention in the moment to something, a sound or a smell or a thought even, that's not seen in connection with Krishna. That's not spiritual. Can I answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. You get the final word.
Hare Krishna. So, my first question is, soul, Satchit Ananda.
Yeah.
Is this the composition of the soul, or
yes,
is this the quality of the soul?
The same. They're both the composition and quality. Why you want to make a distinction between composition and quality?
I don't know.
I just want to ask the question.
I have.
It's the same. It's the same. The language is different. The meaning is the same. Next question.
The reason I'm asking, there are 2-3 points in my mind which is connected to that. But another thing I'm thinking is, many slides we talked about that consciousness is eternal, unchanging, and Buddhist philosophies say when you see a blue thing, your consciousness becomes blue and then it becomes yellow.
That's the subtle body becomes like that.
Subtle.
Not consciousness becomes, you know, the conscious self doesn't become like that. Through the consciousness extending through the senses, and then the information comes back from the object to the mind, then it's blue consciousness.
Right. So now these senses only we use to purify or dissolve our subtle body.
No. Bhakti can only do that.
With the use of our senses.
Huh?
With the use of our senses.
With the use of our senses, yes. But, you know, it's not... I want to make a distinction here that says it's not a mechanical process, is basically what I want to say. It's a devotional process. Depending upon the strength of your bhakti, then the material contamination can be dissolved and the spiritual function can be, you can perceive through the senses. The senses become spiritualized. They can act in a spiritual way. You can see Krishna. But not with material senses.
Not with the material senses.
With spiritualized senses. So we're looking at the deity. You've heard this a million times. And to the material senses is wood, metal, or stone. And people that aren't devotional, that's what they see. And with spiritualized senses, one can see Krishna, not just wood, stone, or metal. Now, it doesn't change wood, stone, or metal to something other than wood, stone, or metal, but it becomes fully spiritualized. So it acts in a fully spiritual way, the same as in our spiritual body serving the spiritual form of Krishna. Only because we have material bodies, we can use the material bodies with these forms and fully realize the presence of Krishna in this form, or the book, or the name, or, you know, prasadam. Because it's spiritual. The senses become spiritualized. Go ahead.
Right. So the reason why I was asking is the desires, because our subtle body will be dissolved when we'll go. So it's only Sachit Ananda, the soul that is going to the spiritual world. So is that sufficient without the desire to serve Krishna?
Is that, say it again, sufficient?
Sufficient to go back or serve Krishna, just the composition of the soul, Sachit Ananda, no desire?
Well, of course there's desire. It's natural for the soul to have desire, the desire to serve Krishna. And therefore, there's a spiritual mind, and there's spiritual senses, and spiritual intelligence.
Yeah.
So you go ahead, ask it again. I'm used to this. You got to ask it 10 times because I'm thick and I don't understand what your questions are. Keep going. Clarify.
I think it's a little bit clear to me.
Huh? Is it clear?
It's a little bit clear to me.
A little bit clearer, okay.
Yeah. One more thing I have in my mind.
Okay.
I thought it was clear, but now I have a little bit doubt after reading this handout.
Okay. Keep going.
Brahmananda and Sahujya Mukti. I thought Brahmananda is like Shukdev Goswami and 4 Kumaras. They are kind of devotees because they know one aspect of Krishna and they accept it.
Yeah.
And Sahujyas, they just deny.
No.
Or they are offensive.
Does it say that in this text that you read? Sahujya says you deny?
They don't say deny. They say, I am thinking that, thinking of Shishupal.
Why are you saying?
The reason I'm asking, there is one sentence.
I want to know the reason. Go ahead.
So it says both of them find happiness by merging in Brahman. So that's what I was thinking. What is the final destination? Let's say if they have not heard about the qualities of Krishna, so what will be the destination of Brahmananda?
It depends. Not all Brahmanandis are the same.
So where will they go? What is their destination?
Well, you know, it's to elaborate, there's details and details and details. So rather than going to the details and details, I'd rather just say, like, for example, it is said that when Shishupal was liberated, his soul merged within the body of Krishna. Right?
Yeah.
And everyone saw it, and Yudhisthira asks about it. According to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, there's 2 types of sayujya. One may merge into the effulgence of Krishna, one may merge into the body of Krishna. He says the second one is worse, because you see that Krishna has a form, and you still want to enter into the body of Krishna rather than the effulgence of Krishna. For example, and there's other diversities of what Sayuja Mukti is, and then the ultimate destination of those that achieve Sayuja Mukti. So I'd rather not go there, although you're curious. It's like way over there. It's not really on our subject. Allow me to not have to go there. There's more diversity besides the 2 I just mentioned. Go ahead.
And another thing is prana air, the vital air force. It is, now does it goes to the spiritual world also, or it is just stays with the soul in the material world? It goes from one body to another?
It depends. Aruya Krishna Param Padam Tada Patantyato Nadvara Yushvarangrayaha. From the Bhagavatam it says, one may enter into this place that's neutral, that's not the Brahmajyoti, but it's a place that's neutral, that's between the spiritual realm and the material realm. there's a neutral place, the viraja, one may go there and then fall down. Or one may enter into the Brahmajyoti. It's complicated. What determines, then after that comes six other questions. What determines this and what determines that and so on and so on. I really don't want to go there. Okay. It's a whole other topic. Can we not go there?
Thank you.
Go ahead. Yes.
Thank you very much, Maharaj. I have a question about what happens to the super soul when the soul enters the spiritual about soul.
He manifests in his original form as Krishna. Say it in reverse. The soul that departs from the spiritual world, Krishna hides himself in the heart as super soul. But there's no super soul in Goloka. There he is, Krishna. Guiding the living entity through love. The bond of love. For living entities have rebelled against that bond of love. He hides himself and directs them. Maya Dyakshina Prakriti. Through the direction of living entities, desire and their deserve, material nature configures itself and he's the witness guiding them. Giving knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. That's super soul function. There's no need of super soul in Goloka or Vaikuntha. There he is, Narayana. From whom super soul has expanded. Isn't that nice? So, loving relationship with Krishna is like that. The direction is spontaneous through love. Instead of, picking and choosing, I'll surrender to this but not to that. Go ahead. That's it?
Thank you.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai.